It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It's a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Let's join in an attitude of prayer. Let us have the fortitude to hear the truths we need to hear, the vision to see what to do with them, and the courage to do it. We pretend for our own amusement that we're not afraid of anything, that we're certainly not afraid of anything that's true, and that we want to build our lives on the foundations of those truths. In some non-threatening ways, it's probably true. In others, it is not. And we find 100 ways silently to let other people determine what we should hear and know and do and be. But we can live with second-hand truths and second-order visions for so long that we find we have lived second-hand and second-order lives. And nobody wants that. And so let us have the fortitude to hear the truths we need to hear, the vision to see what to do with them, and the courage to do it. Here, now, today, tomorrow, always. Amen. Three weeks ago, I was the keynote speaker for the annual district meeting of a Unitarian district out in southeast Massachusetts. And I was asked to talk on the assigned topic of where do we go from here. It was a one-hour speech on where liberal religion and liberal culture are today, how they got there, some critiques of our movement. I'm not sure many of you would be interested in hearing a lot of this, so if you are, you can read the whole thing online. It's on our website. But for this morning, I want to focus on some things that might be more useful that come from this long talk. The reason for asking questions like where we go from here is because, like all mainline denominations, ours has been losing members steadily for the past half century. Though since we're much smaller, we're more vulnerable. How small are we? Well, here's your factoid for the day. I love these. One recent Gallup poll has showed that more Americans believe they have, 15 times more Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens than believe they are Unitarians. That's small. We are working to get a committee together to study the aliens' methods. So the question of where do we go from here has several answers depending on what level you're asking. And I want to talk about three very different kinds of answers to three very different levels. They get more optimistic as they get smaller, you'll see. First, we can consider, and I won't spend too much time on this, we can consider the largest context and ask, where do we go from here as the Unitarian Universalist Association, this small international religious movement? Second, we can ask a lot more locally, where do we go from here is this church in Austin? And third, we can ask, where do we go from here as individual seekers in liberal religious traditions, whether we're in church or not? First, where do we go from here as the UUA? One answer has to be, perhaps nowhere. Everything seems to point to a commitment to denial and a contentment with just dwindling away, not with a bang, but a whimper. It's a very real possibility, and of the colleagues and professors that I consulted in putting together the comments, no one had a more positive picture than that. Why did they say that? More than half the churches in our association now have fewer than 100 members, which means that they can't pay full-time salary to a minister, and most of them don't have any minister, full or part-time. Yet new ministers are graduating from seminary with an average of $40,000 in educational loans to repay, and that's just for a 3-year ministry degree. So they need full-time employment. Times have changed. I spent 7 years in graduate school to get a PhD and graduated owing only $17,500. Today, a PhD could cost students between $80,000 and $100,000. Our first two ministerial interns, Kathy Harrington and Hannah Wells, came here having 3-year degrees from Star King, just ministry degrees, each owing more than $50,000 in student loans. Students simply cannot afford to get advanced education that's going to cost them 2 to 2.5 times as much as ministerial education will. So the ministry that we'll be entering will be less educated than the ministry we've had. This isn't because of lazy people. This is because of tough economics. Last year, men and women were preparing for the Unitarian ministry in 75 different institutions. Now, the UUA only owns 2 of those, Meadville in Chicago and Star King in Berkeley, and there are secret talks, so secret that one of the professors at Meadville who talked to me said he doesn't even know what's being said. There are secret talks to combine the two of them because we can't afford to keep 2 schools open. Now, what that means is that virtually all of our ministers from here on out are simply going to be educated in Christian seminaries, learning the paradigms, the methods, the stories that have to look back to Christianity instead of tools to look forward to a post-Christian world that we're living in and a wildly pluralistic world that we're going to be living in even more. This doesn't look promising to me. Without having educational institutions that actually educate our ministers, we have no means of teaching a unique perspective, even if we could articulate one, which would be a whole other subject. And I don't see a way past this. How long do you think Roman Catholicism would last if 95% of their priests were educated in Buddhist schools? Where we are. Even the quarterly publication, I just learned this week, even the quarterly publication called the UU Voice is easily the most honest, the most candid, and really self-critical of all of our publications. It's been coming out for 40 years. It may have to stop publishing after 40 years because it costs about $6,500 a year to publish it, and the editor who's donating his time doesn't have the money. Amazing. So for these reasons and more, I think one serious answer to where do we go from here as the UUA, as a small international religious movement, is nowhere. From here we continue to fade away. I wanted to give you that uplifting message before we went on. Where we can go from here as a church is a lot more hopeful. People who study churches say that as money gets tighter, surprisingly, the most vulnerable churches are the mid-sized churches, not large or small. Large churches that have learned to operate as well-run businesses usually have enough, big enough budgets, not only to weather storms, but also to hire necessary staff or consultants proactively to deal with them. they can dream in that way because they have the budget to do it. Small churches of under 150 or so that exist as family churches can have the familial cohesion to stick together with or without a minister, and they'll probably survive. But the mid-sized churches no longer have that simple single family model. If you have 250 people, no one can know everyone there anymore. It's not a family. And they lack the budget of larger churches to be able to be proactive in tough times. We're at the very low edge of what's considered a large church category, needing about 200 more members and $200,000 more in the budget before we would be really in a safer place. But we're not in a bad place. Another answer at the church demographics level is that white-haired congregations are visibly grounded in the past, whether this is actually true or not, as churches with younger hair colors are more likely to be invested in the future. That's where they'll be spending most of their lives. There's a lot of talk within the UUA of a commitment to growth, and all seem to mean by this a desire to attract more young people. But younger church cultures are very different, as we've learned, I think, in exciting ways. Young people have different priorities than older people. I think they're also better at taking care of one another. That's certainly been true here. I think it's fair to say that a church structured for the future will be more comfortable for people in their 30s and 40s than it will be for people in their 60s to 80s. Small churches operate a lot like social clubs, in which the guardians, and these are the people that have kept that thing going, by gosh, through thick and thin, which the guardians define the boundaries of both thought and behavior. It's a family, and they're the parents. And the boundaries are defined to fit the comfort zones of the guardians. That's the positive and negative dimension of a family, as you probably know from your own families. Unless they can grow past that in the mid-size level, they'll never be very good or very stable large churches, because large churches can't work that way. This is one of our challenges in this church. It's a challenge I think the board is doing very well with. I think our boards for the last several years have become more and more proactive and forward-looking. It's been a noticeable change in the 6 years that I've been here, and all in the right direction. So third, where do we go from here as individual seekers? And here the picture is a whole lot happier and bigger, though still challenging. The picture can be as intelligent, informed, optimistic, and courageous as the individual seekers are. And you'll see there was a rub in there somewhere. The search for a religious center or for a center to life or a center of taking ourselves and life more seriously, I mean the same thing by all those, doesn't have to start from scratch. Even a quick look at the world's great tradition shows us that religion and good philosophical traditions really do have an enduring subject matter. Their insights measure the quality of our lives and our worlds, for better and worse. Most of these truths do not seem to have changed much in recorded history. They seem to be species-specific traits that humans would develop, but lizards, I think, would not. It's not a political statement. For instance, we know that religion is a human enterprise, not created by the gods, but created by us, sometimes using gods and sometimes not. And it's a human invention. It's one of the ways in which we try to learn and practice ideals that can help us become more fully human. We know this. We know that the way we seek is older than the gods, as Lao Tzu said 2,400 years ago. That's quite a statement. The way of trying to live in fullness and harmony is older than the gods. One lesson of all the gods of all the world's religions is that in time they all die. We want to learn how to relish the transient pleasures of life. See if this doesn't describe you. Learn how to relish the transient pleasures of life without becoming limited and defined by them. And we want to know how to nurture our life-giving circles of friends. This is what the Epicureans were teaching 2,400 years ago. Not new. We know that neither we nor any predictable supernatural agencies can control what life is going to bring our way, in what happens to us, whether accidents, diseases, all the kinds of things that can come our way. So that we need to learn how to control our responses to life. It's the one thing we can control. And that's what the Stoics taught us. Most of us believe in salvation through understanding, as the Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh has put it. This is another way of saying we don't want to check our brains at the church door. We also don't want to check our hearts at the church door either. We need to be reminded in the Roman Seneca's magnificent phrase that we are all limbs on the body of humanity and we must learn to act accordingly. The wonderful image. We know, but want to be reminded, that if only we could treat all others as our equals, our brothers and sisters as though they were all children of God, that we could transform the world into a paradise, which is what Jesus taught as the kingdom of God. All this requires boundaries that are really big. Boundaries of understanding and truth and seeking and curiosity that are bigger than anyone's comfort zone. It isn't easy. It takes personal work. All the world religions think it's hard. Another answer to where we go from here comes from understanding religion as the search for a healthy kind of wholeness, another definition of religion, good one, to become a blessing to a world that's not made in our image. And from the start, the salvation story of most of the best prophets and sages has been the story of salvation by character. We're trying to become better people, partners, parents, and citizens, and we believe that by doing that, life will be more worth living and we will be a blessing to the world as we pass through it. This is about personal authenticity, the kind of authenticity that rejuvenates the world. And you can't get that secondhand. This is going to get harder now. You can't get it by joining a club, a denomination, not even a church. You can't get personal authenticity by putting a fish named Jesus or Darwin on your car trunk. You only get it by doing the self-examination and the personal work. The gifts of all the great prophets and sages of history are absolutely free, but they're not cheap. They can cost us our artificially small identities and the comfort that comes with them. We've never looked back with pride on religious liberals or anyone else who didn't go forward into new and uncharted territory during a crisis of religious expression. We don't remember the names. It's been interesting in Unitarian history to think that even in the heyday of the movement, the mid-19th century, we really only look back on three names, three dead white men whose names we celebrate as being what Unitarians were about. Theodore Parker, William Ellery Channing, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. You realize that what this is saying is 99% of the ministers who serve aren't even worth remembering. Now, this needs to be very sobering for all the living ministers today. Not comforting, but sobering. I consulted, as I said, with some colleagues and professors in trying to put these notes together, and I really didn't get many promising visions from them. I thought I would. But I did get a comment from the Reverend David Bumbaugh, who is professor of ministry at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago, and it's worth sharing. It's really wonderful. He says, I believe we are confronted by three essential and inescapable questions. What do we profess? In whose behalf do we act? And to whom or what are we ultimately responsible? The first question requires that I continually seek to be as clear as I can be about the fundamental convictions that drive my actions and not settle for platitudes, either traditional responses or the seven principles. The second question drives me to broaden the scope of my concerns beyond the horizons of my comfort zone to include the lost, the marginalized, and those who are least like me. If ministry is to be anything more than chaplaincy to those who can afford me, what a phrase. What a phrase. If ministry is to be anything more than chaplaincy to those who can afford me, the answer to the second question, in whose behalf do we act, must continually expand. And David's third question is the theological question of what we're serving that transcends our own wishes, our own kind of people, our own time and place, and how we're to speak about it. 300 years ago, the reflexive answer to this question would have been, well, religion is about God, of course. Just read the Bible. But the world has changed. The largest Hindu temple in North America is in Austin. The city with the widest range of Buddhisms in the entire world is Los Angeles. Now we're charged with trying to serve a spirit of life by once more looking not to the past, but to the future, and offering a structure or style of religion that can build bridges to an unknown future rather than walls around a comfortable but small past. That's tough. Some have compared the times we're living in to the wasteland. Poets love using that because it's so poetic and makes them seem so smug because they're obviously above the wasteland. That term's been with us at least 500 years. In the Middle Ages, when the Arthurian Grail legend, the legend of the Holy Grail, was born, that's what it was talking about. It described the times they were living in as living in the wasteland. But what they meant by that was profound and profoundly modern. Living in the wasteland meant living an inauthentic life. Living a secondhand life with hand-me-down beliefs and not enough information to know or even seek the truths that we need to become more whole and more authentic. Their church and their ruler decided what information they could receive, which is one way to keep people powerless. This is why heresy is so important, the ability to keep choosing when others have ruled the choices closed. This is why courage is so important today. There can't be any questions or inquiries anywhere that are forbidden. I had breakfast, and you had a factoid. Now here's the name dropping for the day. I had breakfast and spent the morning with Norman Lear this past Friday. It was a treat because he's been an idol of mine ever since he wrote and produced the television series All in the Family 35 years ago with Archie Bunker. We talked about religion and his concern that religion is failing us as a society. So many devastating things are going on, he would say. Why are all the pulpits so silent about it? Why are they all so afraid? Bill Moyers and Bishop John Shelby Spong have asked the same questions. And we don't hear much from religious voices unless you count Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. But it's not enough to indict preachers, even though I did feel a little defensive. Think about it. Not many people trust the media to tell us the truths we need to hear either. And even fewer trust politicians or preachers to tell us the hard truths. Mostly we know we'll get something comforting that someone else has decided we can hear. And we live in a time of fearful truths, when a lot of the truths are fearful. Global warming, peak oil, our illegal invasion of Iraq, built on stories we now know to have been lies. The reduction of our civil liberties, stories of our government eavesdropping on our phone calls, important questions about what happened on 9/11 and who was really behind it, stories about how fragile our economy is, whether the Chinese will continue to prop it up artificially, how we're no longer respected by many of our longtime friends in the world, on and on and on. These are fearful truths. They're not truths that can make anyone comfortable to hear them. This web of unexamined truths is the wasteland in which we live now, and it takes uncommon courage actually to want to hear some of these truths. Yet I think the only hope we have for moving forward from here is having unrestricted access to all questions, all inquiries, and the courage to hear and deal with hard truths. Now, I don't mean to point fingers or to imply that we, of course, are all courageous and don't fear anything here. That just isn't true. We each have lines past which we simply become uncomfortable and wish someone else would stop talking. And sometimes we wish we could keep from hearing fearful truths. I don't think there's a human alive for whom this isn't true. The religious myths of Western civilization are crumbling. Though scholars have written about this for well over a century, it's uncomfortable for many people to understand that the symbol God may not be useful or coherent anymore. We may need better ways to talk about the things that are most important. That's a frightening idea for many people. Or that there's nothing up there. That's a frightening idea for many people. No heaven, no afterlife. No supernatural magic we were all taught as children. Don't some of these things make you uncomfortable? Now, maybe the Da Vinci Code doesn't bother you when it suggests that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, and as one scholar I know adds, that they also had two children before they were divorced and Jesus married again. That story may not bother you in this room, but there are other stories that can make you uncomfortable. All of us. This week, for instance, a respected member of this church sent me a news story about Morgan Reynolds. I didn't know the name. Morgan Reynolds was President Bush's Labor Department chief economist and the former director of the Criminal Justice Center. He gave a speech to a standing room only audience of over 1,000 at the University of Wisconsin 2 weeks ago. He's emeritus professor of economics from Texas A&M. He doesn't sound like a left-wing nutcase. But what he said was that 9/11 was an inside job, and he fingered Bush, Cheney, and others for the murder of nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11. As part of their plan to transform America to a command and control government, to restrict civil rights, wage an imperialistic war, and the rest of it. He said he believes some government insiders will be coming forward soon to tell their stories that the information had been kept so compartmentalized that few involved had any idea of the scope of the administration's plan for 9/11. If this proves to be true, it may be the most fearful truth in U.S. history. It's fearful to me, and I think it would make every single American very uncomfortable and frightened. You really want to know? Or would you rather be protected from these truths if they turn out to be true? And then who would you trust to limit your access to this knowledge? The politicians? The media, your neighbor, the people sitting a row behind you here? Anyone? Fearful truths test our mettle. It was only 6 years ago that enough old government documents became declassified, including military communications from 1940 to 1941, to show pretty conclusively that Pearl Harbor was not a surprise attack, that FDR wanted it to happen and helped it to happen, sacrificing 2,400 soldiers in Pearl Harbor in order to rouse our country to enter World War II. That's made me very uncomfortable. And I can understand why the government and the media have not wanted to spread this story widely. But without these truths, we have no chance of understanding what's going on and how the strings are being pulled that move our world. Who would you trust to decide what you can't hear, can't know, and can't discuss? Anyone? I hope not. Because where we go from here as individuals, as churches, and as a society can only have a hopeful future if we have the courage to hear fearful truths and then together to figure out how to respond to them. We really have a proud heritage, both as Americans and as religious liberals. We stand on the shoulders of giants who have pushed people to deal with truths they didn't want to hear, to cross over past their comfort zones that they didn't want to cross. We look back on them with gratitude for the courage they showed when it was their turn. Now it's our turn. Where we go from here will depend on the quality of our own understanding and our own courage. So as we move into the future, we need to spend less time worshiping history and a lot more time making it. Now, see, you came here hoping to hear a safe talk about where other people might need to go from here. And now you find out that it was all about you all along. Welcome to our church.